Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's Lumen Lecture, the first in our spring semester in this school academic year of Lumen Lectures. We've been privileged and blessed so far this school year to hear from Dr. Steve Garber, Dr. Stanley Hauerwas, and tonight's guest will be a treat for you as well. He'll be introduced in just a moment. The Lumen Lecture Series is designed to be an opportunity for you as various students, faculty, and staff, for us to think about the intersection of faith and learning. And so this series is designed to bring in really top-notch leading Christian scholars who can address various issues related to our faith and life. Maybe they connect to your academic discipline from time to time. Tonight will certainly fit that bill. We also have coffee and refreshments in the back that you can take advantage of. At the conclusion of the lecture tonight, for those of you who are interested, you can purchase our speaker's book in the back, Dr. Marsh's biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think he will be happy to sign any copies that you purchase for him at that point. To introduce our speaker, I want to introduce you to one of the students who works in the office of the chaplain. Sophomore Matthew Robinson is a religion major and a big Bonhoeffer fanatic. So he's going to come up and tell us a little bit more about our speaker. Would you join me in welcoming your peer, Matthew Robinson? Yeah.
Good evening. Welcome. We are privileged today to have Dr. Charles Marsh with us this evening. And Dr. Marsh is a professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia, as well as the director of the Project on Lived Theology. His most recent book is Strange Glory, A Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which is available for purchase at the end of tonight in the back. He's also the author of seven previous books, including God's Long Summer, Stories of Faith and Civil Rights, which won the 1998 Graumeier Award in Religion. Dr. Marsh was a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2009 and the 2010 Ellen Maria Gorison Prize Fellowship at the American Academy in Berlin. He lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, and please join me in welcoming Dr. Charles Marsh.
That was a beautiful introduction. Thank you so very much, Matthew, and to all of you for making me feel so much at home. And this, my first visit to Berry College. I hope it won't be the last. Thanks to Dr. Higgins and to President Briggs and to all who've made this such a happy day. I often see your college, Berry College, listed alongside my university, the University of Virginia, in these lists describing America's most beautiful universities and colleges. And it certainly lives up to all the expectations I had of Berry. So thank you. It was the beginning of 1933, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer was still enjoying the long Christmas break. Having moved back from his parents' house on Wangenheimstrasse, he worked every morning from his bedroom, his notes carefully arranged on the oak writing table that had been his desk since boyhood. With a westward view of the neighbor's frozen garden, he wrote lectures and sermons with the familiar economy of effort, though now with the aid of a new Alder, his first typewriter. He wrote to his friend, Erwin Zoops, I have finally joined the technical era. Afternoons were set aside for naps, meeting friends over coffee, writing letters. Weather permitting, there was skiing on the well-marked trails of the Grunewald. Most evenings, he went into the city for a concert or a play. Musical nights at the Bonhoeffer's family house continued a most pleasant Saturday ritual. During a short stay in Friedrichsbrunn, he lolled about reading Hegel and Heine. A little over 2 weeks later, on January 30th, the unimaginable happened. There had been signs. On the very day that Bonhoeffer's Genesis lectures had turned to the story of Cain, second son of Adam and Eve, who jealously murders his brother Abel to become the first destroyer of life, the stormtroopers had appeared in the streets, bearing their hideous rubber truncheons, their drums and flags. On that day, too, Adolf Hitler, a German citizen for less than a year, had been appointed by President Paul von Hindenburg as the new Reich Chancellor. Nothing would ever be the same in the wake of that. Not the world of the mind or the world of politics, not Europe or the world outside it. A city once contoured by the hopeless, godless vacancy of satisfied faces was suddenly transformed with an enormous sense of purpose. Now would be the time of massed armies, the restlessness of turbulent mobs, the time of huge throngs moving over the face of the earth, of technicians planning grandiose acts of destruction. Bonhoeffer's life was set on a collision course with Hitler's. In the 7 decades since his execution on Hitler's orders for the crime of high treason in the concentration camp of Flossenbürg, an event we commemorate this spring, 70 years after the fact, Dietrich Bonhoeffer has become one of the most influential and widely cited and much loved religious thinkers of the modern era. Everyone from Vaclav Havel to Jimmy Carter to Saint Bono of U2 fame considers Bonhoeffer an inspiration and a kind of fellow traveler. His life and legacy have inspired campaigns for social justice, for human rights, for civil rights. Generations of men and women have taken a more active role in the churches and in the various human rights institutions' engagement in the social order. My students at UVA read Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and they are struck by his conviction, his power, his humanity, the civil courage he exhibited in his vocation as a non-Nazi, anti-Nazi pastor. Bonhoeffer's more popular works, some of you may have read these, like Life Together or Cost of Discipleship. These books that were written amid all the turmoil and the chaos of the church struggle against Hitler, these are remarkable books because they offer such profound insights in the nature of faith while also being accessible and inviting and without reducing complex ideas to cliches. In fact, one of the aspects of Bonhoeffer's life and legacy that continues to draw me back to his writings is that no other Christian thinker I know in the modern era, perhaps with the exception of Dr. Martin Luther King, crosses quite so many boundaries and brings so many diverse people together around the table to talk about the relation between faith and the common good. Liberals and evangelicals, Catholics and Protestants, Christians and Jews, believers and unbelievers, all romantics and, you know, and pessimists all come to Bonhoeffer's story with a sort of a shared admiration for what is an indisputably authentic witness. And indeed, his story is a remarkable one. born into a family of great privilege and a family of prodigiously humanist parents. Bonhoeffer was one of the only religious members of his family. At the age of 14 years old, he announced, to the chagrin of his skeptical brothers, that he wanted to become a theologian. And when his older brothers responded by saying, "Really? You know, you, a theologian? We hardly ever go to church, and a more paltry institution than the church, one can hardly imagine. If you decide to pursue a career as a theologian, you will be living your entire life in full intellectual retreat from the modern world." Young Dietrich, at the age of 14, said, "Well, in that case, I shall reform the church." By the age of 21, this golden child of the Berlin Grunewald, of this extraordinarily brilliant and talented and gifted family and culture, had earned his first doctorate degree. By the age of 24, he had his second doctorate degree, his second doctoral. The great theologian Karl Barth described Bonhoeffer's dissertation, written at the age of 21, as a theological sensation, eine theologische Überraschung. But this restless soul, with an uncommon hunger to see new places, just like most of us, and to experience life beyond his native land, his native region, would travel widely and whenever possible. And one of the most enjoyable parts of researching this book was in seeking to try in each chapter to create a strong sense of place. I know there's a class being taught here in the writing program on sense of place, and Southerners have a keen sense of place. I went to every place Bonhoeffer lived and that influenced or that impressed upon him, you know, deep transformations, in order to try to get a sense of that place, the atmospherics, the color, the smells, the texture, in hopes of bringing the story alive. And between 1922 and 1932 alone, and this was quite unusual for Germans of his day, he would travel to Italy, to Libya, to northern Africa, to Spain, France, Morocco, Cuba, Mexico, and the United States. And encounters and experiences during these years of travel, experience that included an amazing 6 weeks in Rome during Holy Week of 1924, when this Lutheran from Germany came under the complete charm of Italian Catholicism and all of its, you know, festivity and ritual and pageantry in Rome during Holy Week, that was transformative. These encounters included a six month immersion in the African American churches of the United States. It included a road trip like Jack Kerouac style road trip in an old beat up Ford in the spring of 1931 with three Europeans that logged 4,000 miles in 6 weeks, then another 1,400 miles on Mexican trains that took Bonhoeffer, this curious German, not only west and through Texas, but indeed through the deep south during the most difficult and oppressive days of the Jim Crow era. These experiences challenged Bonhoeffer to rethink his vocation as a theologian, to rethink his vocation as a citizen, and his notions of what it meant to be patriotic, and finally to embark, and I love this phrase, on what he would call a turning from the phraseological to the real. Isn't that an interesting phrase? He once wrote in prison, he said, "You know, there are only two times in my life when I observe, looking back, profound transformation. Under the strong impression of my father, And his father was a preeminent psychiatrist who demanded that his children speak and think and argue clearly and with strong, well-rehearsed arguments. And then my first experiences abroad, it was then, he said, that I began to make the turning from the phraseological to the real. So I began work on this biography in the spring of 2007, when I was fortunate enough to have a visiting professorship at the University of Berlin. It was called the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Visiting Professorship at Humboldt University in Berlin. And as I told a class earlier today, I know that sounds like a very prestigious title, but I should tell you that it came with no salary, no travel stipend, no housing allowance, but I did have a very cozy office in a building near the River Spree, across the river, across from the Berlin Dome. And if I stood on my desk and looked out the tiny little window, I could see the Fernsehturm, you know, that big television tower, towering over the Alexanderplatz. And soon enough, I made my first trip to the city library in Berlin. I mean, that sounds kind of like a geeky thing to do, but nonetheless, I was really excited about it. This beautiful, capacious Staatsbibliothek designed by one of the great modernist German architects, Hans Scherun, who also designed the beautiful Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra buildings near the Potsdamer Platz. And there and indulge me a minute in my sort of geekiness here, with the supervision of a very kindly director of special collections, and sometimes the real heroes behind books that take 10 years to write are not only family members, but archivists and directors of special collections. And Dr. Jette Weber was no exception. But here's what happened. For a period of weeks, days and weeks and months, I went over to the Staatsbibliothek and I read documents and papers that were part of this big stash, maybe 25 boxes of documents that had recently been given to the library by the estate of Bonhoeffer's best friend, Eberhard Baecke. And Dr. Weber, even though these documents had not been, you know, classified and categorized, gave me a nice pair of white gloves, which I'm supposed to wear when I read these documents, and a number two pencil certified by the nation of Germany, the state of Germany, nothing but a number two pencil certified. And otherwise, I could just go through these documents. And as I poured through these lectures and papers and photographs and notebooks and journals, Bonhoeffer was an avid journaler, which is, you know, a biographer's dream. And while many of these documents would appear in the 16-volume complete writings of Bonhoeffer we now have, the singularities of his life, the sort of idiosyncrasies, the details of his life, the evidence of which I held in my hands every morning, began to illuminate in my mind a very different image of this great Christian thinker and martyr and resistance worker and human rights activist than the one I had carried with me for 25 years since writing a lumbering doctoral dissertation on his philosophical thought in 1989. What did I find? A few things. I found a registration papers for a brand new Audi convertible that his father purchased for him when he was about to launch a seminary of dissident pastors. Bonhoeffer was a member of the anti-Nazi dissident group of Christians, and he built and founded a seminary up along the Baltic Sea that was intended to raise up a generation of pastors who would go into the churches and preach against the Hitler regime. And I love this image of this Protestant abbot, this kind of, you know, overseer of an experiment in what Bonhoeffer called new monasticism, chauffeuring his country boy parsons around in this brand new Audi convertible. I found a bank slip from a joint account that he shared with his best friend, Eberhard Baker, a very interesting discovery. I found files. The first box I opened, it must have been a file of 300 pages of articles and pamphlets on American race relations. This is so interesting that Bonhoeffer came to the United States and he became fascinated by race relations in America, and he studied and visited the NAACP, and he had documents on lynchings and on the history of black legal action and collections of black sermons and political manuscripts. I found inventories of his wardrobe. Turns out the great martyr of the church and resistance worker was a fashion hound, and he loved nice clothes, and he was proud of his sartorial splendor, and he kept a very detailed record of the best places to buy fur coats in Berlin and where the best leather shoes could be made and the like. Not so surprisingly, I found inventories of his library that were very meticulous. Not so surprising because this is the theologian who, around the age of 12, wrote in, I think, his last letter to Father Christmas. He knew Santa Claus didn't exist, but he indulged his parents, asking for the complete works of Immanuel Kant. I found gorgeous, austere landscape photographs that he had taken on his two trips to northern Africa, a fortnight in Libya and then 2 or 3 days in Morocco. Beautiful, respectful studies of this of the Muslim world that was to him quite exotic, quite different, but also quite moving and profound. I found a correspondence that he and the great Mahatma Gandhi maintained in the spring of 1934. Bonhoeffer, shortly after the passage of the Nuremberg Laws in 1933, which made illegal the employment of Jews or anyone of Jewish lineage in civil or religious employment in the nation of Germany, Bonhoeffer began thinking about the importance of creating a community, an intentional community that was based on faith and peacemaking and centered around spiritual and contemplative disciplines. And he had read Gandhi's work, and he reached out to Gandhi, and Gandhi invited him to come live on an ashram for 6 months, and it was one of Bonhoeffer's great regrets that he was never able to make it to India. I felt in these early weeks of research a gentle but a very much welcome nudge into biographical writing. I want to read a short section from the book at this point, and let me set it up in this manner. So by 1939, Bonhoeffer was a marked man. Hitler came to power in 1933. Within 2 weeks of the passage of the Aryan laws and the Nuremberg laws, Bonhoeffer went on record in one document denouncing the law's application to Jews, and in a second document saying this, that in response to state violence and oppression, that the churches must respond to the state not only by jamming the spoke in the wheel or slowing down the wheel of the state, but if necessary, by destroying the wheel altogether. A remarkable, prescient remark Bonhoeffer is making as he begins in these early days to discern the specter of Nazi monstrosity and grotesquerie emerging on the scenes in 1933. By the end of that year, he had drafted statements in opposition to the Aryan laws, and he had become one of the nation's most conspicuous dissidents. By 1939, however, his attempt, Bonhoeffer's attempt, to try to undermine the legitimacy of the Hitler regime through the witness of the church, by creating this confessing church and a powerful grouping of men and women who would speak against the day in opposition to Hitler. As beautiful as an experiment as the confessing church was, by 1939, it had been obliterated. And the Gestapo had put it out of business, and this beautiful experiment and intentional community where the books Life Together were written, where Cost of Discipleship was given as a lecture, was boarded up by the Gestapo. And Bonhoeffer, the pastor and seminarian, had no church. He was a man who was writing from a variety of places, planes, trains, and automobiles, and he had also just learned that he would very soon be called up to serve in Hitler's army. And Bonhoeffer had made clear that under no circumstances would he ever fight for Adolf Hitler. Filing as a conscientious objector was not an option for a German in 1939. In fact, the refusal to serve and to respond to draft papers was a capital punishment, punishable indeed by incarceration in a concentration camp and by execution. And so some of Bonhoeffer's friends in New York and in the United States and abroad hurriedly put together a teaching position for him in New York. And the idea was that he could come to America during these horrific years and he could sit out the war in the relative privilege of Northeast academe. And this is the story of Bonhoeffer's long dark night of the soul in New York City in the summer of 1939 that led to his return and finally to his martyrdom. On a warm morning in June 1939, Bonhoeffer left Germany on his second journey to America. "I'm flying over the channel in the glow of a pink sunset," he wrote to his friend Eberhard on June 4th. "It's 10 o'clock, but still very bright. You will be tired and gone to bed now, but I'm doing well." After a week-long layover in England, he boarded the Bremen for the 5-day ocean voyage to New York. Pleased with his spacious cabin and the appointments of the ship, he read and napped in a lounge chair on the hardwood deck. He was content to be alone. "The weather is wonderful and the ocean is quiet," he told Eberhard. "I'll spend a lot of time thinking of you and all the other brethren." "Today is Sunday. No worship service," he wrote from the deck of the luxury liner on the second day. The change in time zones had already prevented his taking part remotely in Baker's worship as it was happening. Their growing distance had already caused a clear new day to dawn in the mid-Atlantic. "But I am fully with you today more than ever, if only the doubts about my path were overcome." Dietrich found New York much changed since his last visit nearly a decade before. The new Empire State Building had transformed the skyline, though it stood mostly tenantless. Robert Moses's titanic public works program was evident, with new bridges and roadways in the works. In April, the World's Fair had opened in Queens to great fanfare in the Bronx. Lou Gehrig was playing in this last season for the Yankees and would retire midsummer, having set the record for consecutive games played. The movie, The Wizard of Oz, premiered on August 17th at Lowe's Capitol Theater. John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, published by Viking Press, won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. Somewhat less conspicuously, an unabridged edition of Mein Kampf appeared for the first time in English. Bonhoeffer could not summon the sense of optimism and wonder and adventure that had attended his last sojourn in America. The hard lessons of the previous years had brought him closer to Niebuhr's realism, and Harlem was no longer on his mind. At the World's Fair, his heart sank to see something called the Temple of Religion, where, under an enormous tent, Christians and Jews were preaching in turns, like in a circus act. He arrived at Union Theological Seminary on the Upper West Side in the middle of the summer vacation on the first day of a heat wave. The brick and limestone fortress sprawling between Broadway and Claremont was a world away from the rustic estate where Finkenwalde, the seminary, had not too long ago flourished, even further from the modest parish houses of the collective pastorates. He unpacked his bags in the room for visiting scholars, the prophet's chamber, it was called. But what kind of a prophet was he? At least he had plenty of space. With the temperature soaring into the mid-90s, it was impossible to shut the windows, and with one window giving onto the interior courtyard, the other onto Broadway, the street noise persisted until late at night, even then abating only little. The airlessness was enervating, and so was the lack of society. Reinhold Niebuhr had advised Bonhoeffer to come to New York as soon as possible, which Bonhoeffer took to heart. But when he arrived in New York on the morning of June 12th, his American host, decent and thoughtful people, were nowhere to be found. They were off at their summer homes. Bonhoeffer passed the time smoking cigarettes, reading, and taking walks. He visited the Metropolitan Museum, where he lingered over El Greco's view of Toledo and Hans Memling's Christ giving his blessing. He tried to catch up on the latest American theology, and he thumbed through recent issues of the Christian Century. But he found all the books and articles ultimately uninspiring. Every few weeks, he rang his brother, Carl Friedrich, for a quick chat. His brother was in the final month of a sabbatical year at the University of Chicago. He made entries, Bonhoeffer did, in his brown leather journal, a going-away present from his best friend, Eberhard. Never one to give inventory of his interior life, Bonhoeffer was now left with few other options amid what felt like the shock of separation. Later, in prison, on hot summer days in his stifling cell, he would tell his parents not to worry about him, seeing as how he had survived the heat of Italy, Africa, Spain, Texas, Mexico, and worst of all, New York City in the summer of 1939. As a sensitive child, he had always been content with small pleasures, whether accompanying his mother as they sang the Gellert Beethoven songs, collecting wildflowers in the glades near his home, or reading stories aloud with his twin sister Sabina in the hours after school in the garden. In his union dormitory, he drank coffee, ate moderately, smoked immoderately, and sat at his desk with a floor fan, taking the little relief it offered. He was able to make a few acquaintances who didn't live according to the academic calendar. Paul Griswold Macy, a scion of the Macy's department store fortune and a sturdy Protestant churchman, met Bonhoeffer on his first night in town for drinks at a hotel. Henry Smith Leiper showed him around the Federal Council of Churches. And William Sloan Coffin, the seminary president, invited Bonhoeffer to come with him by train to his country house in the Berkshires. Of all his New York acquaintances, Bonhoeffer liked Coffin with his refreshing candor and deliberate piety best of all. And his admiration grew only as he discovered Coffin to be a clear and practical man who understood the necessity of preaching the gospel with a generous conviction, a side of him Bonhoeffer had probably missed the last time he was in New York. And he liked Coffin's joke that Niebuhr preaches a half hour about the failure of man and the last 2 minutes about the grace of God. Bonhoeffer told his parents that the Connecticut countryside reminded him of the area around Friedrichsbrunn, which is this beautiful area in the eastern Harz Mountains where the Bonhoeffer family had a summer home. He breathed a little easier on the porch of Coffin's Lakeland home. And with a glass of cold gin and the fresh and luxuriant landscape rolling to the horizon. He had never seen fireflies before, not in the eastern Harz Mountains and not even in Texas on this trip there. But during the evening in the Berkshires, thousands of fireflies, along with flying glowworms, flashed against the fading daylight like shooting stars. Quite a fantastic sight, he wrote in his diary. Aiming to lift Bonhoeffer's clearly flagging spirits, the Coffins and some of their friends held dinner parties in their homes or took him to concerts and plays. Ultimately, however, they would fail to relieve him of his apprehension. The best efforts of these fine families and energetic men could not overcome his sense of dislocation. Everything felt suddenly weighted with melancholy. Here's an entry from his journal. Since yesterday evening, my thoughts cannot get away from Germany. In the morning, a car drive that was in itself beautiful to a woman acquaintance in the countryside and the mountains, but it almost felt unbearable to me, sitting for an hour chatting, not stupidly, but about matters that were just so utterly trivial to me. This inactivity, this pursuit of trivialities, I would have liked to have taken the next ship. The situation at home, it was now clear, had depleted his lifelong love of idle pleasures to a remarkable degree. Dietrich had become consumingly serious. Amid the outings and the pleasantries and the cocktail hours of the New York summer set, he had found no time for Bible study and prayer. All I really need, he lamented in a journal, is Germany, the brethren, my sisters. I do not understand why I am here. Back in Manhattan, he sought relief from the weight bearing down on him with the assurances of Scripture. In the Bible's cold, sober comforts, there were no quick remedies to be found, but he wasn't seeking anything of the kind. He read Lamentations, the Psalms, and the Hebrew prophets. They spoke to the virtue of patience. It is good that one should wait patiently and quietly for the salvation of the Lord. As he had done throughout his adult life, he followed the daily readings of Scripture in the Losungen, the devotional book of the Moravian Brethren that his governess had given him as a child. He pondered the lines from Isaiah, "You are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. The Lord is my strength and my shield. In him my heart trusts." How excellent were these daily readings, he said. And despite the divide of an ocean, reading them in sync with Eberhard and with the brethren, the former seminarians, sustained a spiritual bond that overcame in these weeks the earthly distance. In the prophet's chamber, he wrote in fits and starts. Over the years, Bonhoeffer had rarely labored over assignments, sermons, books, or letters. writing, remarkably, involved the smooth transcription of well-organized thoughts. But now the subject seemed more complicated than even the mysteries of the incarnate, crucified, and risen Christ. He was trying to understand himself. Is it cowardice and weakness to run away from the here and now? I can hardly tear my thoughts away from Germany. I am not quite clear, he wrote in another entry, about my motives. Introspection, a new pursuit for him, had reduced him to these probing thoughts and meditations on the most elementary matters. I would not have thought it possible, he said, that at my age, after so many years abroad, I could become so desperately, terribly homesick. It vexed Bonhoeffer, too, that his best friend Eberhard seemed not to share his urgency to respond, to write back, and he scolded his friend in his own voluminous epistolary outpourings. I wait for mail. It can hardly be endured. Please send me more mail. I can't stay here for long. Meanwhile, the gospel's own urgency was making itself felt. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. God's word today states, see, I am coming soon. Bonhoeffer did not ask about race relations, mentioning only a noon conversation with two students from the South about the problems of African Americans. And he was, to be sure, saddened to learn that apart from the Wagner Bill, an anti-lynching measure debated in both houses of Congress in 1934, but ultimately filibustered into oblivion, nothing had really changed. He asked about American Jews and noted in his journal the great increase in anti-Semitism he observed in the United States. He had seen two advertisements in a local paper that read, a mountain resort 1,000 feet high outside of New York, too high for the Jews, Gentiles preferred. Bonhoeffer went to Riverside Church for a sermon on Sunday, June 18th, given not by Harry Emerson Fosdick, but by one Alfred E. Lecoq, president of homiletics at Yale. This pastor Lecoq ruminated in his sermon on William James's phrase, accepting a horizon, which Bonhoeffer described as discreet, opulent, self-satisfied, and trivial. The sermon left such a bad taste in his mouth that he sought out another service the same night somewhere he might hear the gospel preached to clear his mind of Lecoq's insipid remarks. And indeed, he went to John McComb's evangelical church at Broadway Presbyterian and was delighted to hear a sermon preached from the Bible on being conformed to Christ. But what dreadful music they played there, he lamented. In Germany, baptisms now routinely concluded with the prayer that this child will grow up to be like Adolf Hitler. The theology departments now existed for the sole purpose of building a religious foundation for the new Nazi state. Bonhoeffer had provocatively claimed that the German Protestant who is not aligned with the confessing church is not a Christian. To this, Martin Sasse, a Nazi bishop of Thuringia, responded, in Germany, there is no real spiritual life except in solidarity with our beloved Führer. The German Christians were the Nazi Christians, had waged a seven-year campaign to make the churches safe for the German Reich, winning virtually all of their parishioners to the Nazi cause. By 1939, most high-ranking members of the regime, beginning with the Führer himself, were of the mind, however, that Christianity was ultimately no different from Judaism in its enfeebling effects on the folk. Hitler concluded that the religion of Jesus, a Jew, after all, was at last a malignant, corrupting, toxic influence. A faith of and for only the darker races, not compatible with the grandeur and purity of the Aryan soul. Bonhoeffer, you see, had long argued that Christianity and Judaism were inseparable in the end. And the Nazis seemed to agree, though with a grotesquely different purpose. The anti-Semitic journal Der Stürmer ran a cartoon of a Jewish man raising the hat of a Christian cleric over his head. There is no question of his race. He has an angular, attenuated nose, and his bloated form is naked, but for a crest and the Star of David. He also has a tail and cloven hoofs. And the caption reads, "The church under good protection." So even the true church of Christ was dismissed as a Jewish poison. Bonhoeffer continued to write from New York in fretful, revelatory burst. "I no longer know where I am. I cannot make out why I am here, whether the end will justify it. I cannot believe it is God's will that I should stay on here in the event of war without particular assignment." Well, when the new visiting scholar first opened the doors of Union's prophet chamber at the start of the fall semester 1939, he would be taken aback by the mess, which no one had yet bothered to clean up after the prior tenant. An ashtray on the desk overflowed with cigarette stubs and burned matches, crumpled writing papers, dozens and dozens of wadded up sheets lined the floor. This young scholar could make out a German word or two, otherwise the handwriting was illegible. Had he been able to decipher Bonhoeffer's pinched cursive, he might have learned the reason for the previous occupant's abrupt departure. "Christians in Germany," the letter went, "will face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of the nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice in security. I have come to the conclusion that I made a mistake in coming to America and in return to Germany to suffer with the brethren and ultimately to face martyrdom. In a time of deception, propaganda, and mass violence, Bonhoeffer, as we know and as we have seen, saw clearly how dangerous new forces were emerging in world history that could not have been seen in the old alternatives. He pondered whether there would arise, in response to the challenges of our time, responsible men and women, disciples of Christ, people of all religious traditions, who would have the strength to stand fast, to remain honest, and to live with civil courage in the face of deception and lies. Bonhoeffer asked difficult questions. Is the time of words over? Is the time when Christians have said so many things about God just run the language into the ground? Has the Christian faith become indistinguishable from the nation or from our tribe or from our culture? He said, even in one of these later writings, that it may be a time for silence when our witness is limited to prayer and righteous action. He asked whether humankind had reached a point where it no longer even needed the hypothesis of God, whether righteous action, whether done by a Christian or non-Christian, might be itself a sacramental mystery. More than anything else, he asked the question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? In his protest against fascism and totalitarianism and religiously inspired xenophobia, in its early and consistent support of the Jews and other victims of state-sponsored violence, in his global perspective and cosmopolitan sensibilities, and in his robust and, one might say, pervasively evangelical humanism and commitment to live in truth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer appears to us as a Christian for our time. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. We have a few minutes for comments and questions. I'll be happy to respond in these minutes we have left. Yes, please.
All right. So you talked about how he was engaged in the race relations with the pamphlets and Jim Crow laws. Did he see any comparisons between Jim Crow and the laws against the Nazi German passing?
That's such a great question. Did Bonhoeffer see any comparison between his study of race relations in the United States and anti-Semitic laws that were appearing on the horizon in 1931 in Germany? And in that first trip to the United States, okay, so Bonhoeffer had finished two doctorates. He came to the U.S. 24, 25 years old, convinced that there was nothing the Americans could teach him. You know, he was supremely confident in his erudition. And in fact, after one of the first lectures at Union, he rushed down to the front and he said to Professor Niebuhr, "Is this a theological seminary or a training school for politicians and community organizers?" And Niebuhr said, it's the latter. No, I don't know what Niebuhr said. Niebuhr would have said, you know, why separate the two? In any case, there were three sort of communities or traditions in America that Bonhoeffer encountered during that year that were deeply transformative to him. The first was what we might call the tradition of American social theology. Now, to be sure, the sort of Protestant liberal social theology that was taught at Union in 1931 was not Bonhoeffer's cup of tea, but he was very moved by the image of American theological professors who felt comfortable in the podium, but also leading a group of students out into the community to do organizing and to help in homeless, you know, shelters and housing and teach for America, teach for Deutschland, or whatever. He was very moved by that. He had never seen anything like this in the more formal, staid, refined tradition of German academe. And in some respects, he was able to see through this sort of social engagement of Union theologians and Protestant theologians in America a new way of thinking about the theological vocation. The second world, the second sort of tradition he encountered is what we might call the tradition of American social organizing. And so what I mean by that is Union and American Protestantism in that period was enjoying a kind of golden age of innovation in sort of, you know, social gospel ministries in the world. And Bonhoeffer kept long files on, you know, and he visited these, you know, he visited organization ministries in the tenement houses, ministries for addiction, ACLU, NAACP, social ministries involved in helping undocumented workers and immigration issues. And he was amazed by how the seminarians could talk about, you know, matters other than just sort of, you know, serious Lutheran doctrine, that they were, in fact, more interested in talking about, let's go to Southwest Georgia and build a demonstration plot for the kingdom of God, which is just what Clarence Jordan did 10 years later during this period when he built Quantity of Farm. And, you know, Habitat for Humanity sprang out of Quantity of Farm years later. One of Bonhoeffer's classmates at Union was a white a country boy from the hills of East Tennessee, who later wrote in a journal that the only reason he had ever been accepted to Union is because Union was looking for a token hillbilly. And he happened to apply in 1930. A man named Miles Horton, who after he finished Union Theological Seminary, returned to Tennessee, and at a place called Mount Eagle, Tennessee, built a center called the Highlander Folk School. This was one of Bonhoeffer's best friends in New York. This blew his mind. And so it was part, so this encounter with the tradition of American social organizing and then the tradition of the African American church, in which he experienced a profound six-month immersion. And on the eve of returning to Germany, he wrote his brother back in Berlin, explaining some of the lessons he had learned. And he said, and you know, describing the ACLU and its work in defending, at the time, so-called illegal aliens and enforcing working against deportations. He said, we will soon need in Germany an ACLU of our own. So there were profound ways in which he made the connection. So as I think I told you earlier today, you know, he took this collection of the Negro spirituals back to Germany. He took a collection, a large crate of recordings that he had collected in New York that became really the heart of the worship and sort of, you know, spiritual center of the resistance church. And, you know, I shared with you that wonderful image of these 60, 70 Lutheran seminarians preparing to take pastorates in non-Nazi, anti-Nazi parishes who were standing around a piano with their big steins of German beer and their German cigars. And Bonhoeffer is playing the piano and perhaps very theatrically in this semi-abandoned manor house on the Pomeranian plains, and they're singing Go Down Moses. And the discovery that the German resistance movement was clustered around many of the same freedom songs and spirituals and gospels that would animate the civil rights movement to come was a really delightful surprise in my research. So, great question. Yes, please. That's right.
Do you believe that by the time he was in prison that he had, from your research you've done, do you believe that by that time he had kind of just abandoned denominational lines and just become so universal and staking because of his disappointment with what happened?
That's such a great question. And I agree. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you and I might get some disagreement from scholars in the field, but descriptively, historically, that's exactly what happened. That is to say, the main Protestant church, the evangelical church, the Lutheran church, was thoroughly Nazified by the end of 33. And Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth and Martin Niemöller and some other courageous pastors led this so-called Kirchenkampf, the church struggle, to try to retain the independence and what they called the purity of doctrine from the imposition of the Nazi regime. But Bonhoeffer eventually, as much as he loved the brethren, the younger men he tutored and mentored in this movement, became quite discouraged by its inability to speak in a collective voice a clear and decisive statement against the Nazi government. That is, the confessing church was preoccupied finally with the autonomy of the church, and it would not even speak in a unified voice against the political regime. And so it was shut down and by the Gestapo by 38 anyway. And by 39, Bonhoeffer didn't have a church. I mean, there was no church. The church was in ruins. And he, as a pastor who had a very high view of his ordination and priestly calling, continued to preach and to distribute the sacraments and celebrate in small clusters that gathered in parish houses or in illegal spaces or in the back of pubs or sometimes in monasteries, because several Catholic monasteries were accommodating at times when the Protestant churches were completely Nazified. And so when Bonhoeffer writes in one of his last little documents in prison, shortly before his execution, what shall the church do after the ruins of the war? The church must give away all its money. The church must liquidate all its assets. The church must, in a sense, return to the catacombs. The church must be led by men and women who don't have full-time religious callings, but are employed in the secular sphere. He was almost imagining this, that the language of the Christian faith had become so profaned, it had become so desecrated, so misused, it had been co-opted by the Nazis and, of course, abandoned by the Nazis, but the identification in the churches of Hitler with the voice of God had made the Christian language, had stripped the Christian faith of its power, the language of its mystery. And Bonhoeffer thought, the only way forward in the ruins of Western Christendom is through a period of silence, a period in which people worship and continue to speak and profess the mysteries of the faith, but in small clusters. The whole notion of denominational hierarchies and institutions for him was a part of a tradition that had run aground in the war. Now, we don't know beyond that what he would have done had he survived, but these are thoughts that he's sharing with us on the threshold of eternity. Okay, we have time for one more question. Yes, please. Great question. How Dr. King and Bonhoeffer were able to really animate people behind social justice and the work of the church in the world. I am very hopeful of your generation and of students I teach and voices that I think are prophetic and powerful and that speak out of the same tradition as Bonhoeffer and King. And look, each of us in our own sphere of influence, whether we're teachers or ministers or lawyers or we run bakeries or we're, you know, sommeliers or my cousin is a sommelier. I'm going to see him tomorrow, hopefully with some nice wine of his. We can tell these stories. And you know what happens? I can tell you after 25 years of teaching is that when I go into a classroom and I introduce students to King and Bonhoeffer, to Fannie Lou Hamer, to Dorothy Day, to Clarence Jordan, you know, to a whole cast of my theological heroes, their imaginations come alive, and illuminated in their thoughts are ways of incarnating those stories and those visions in the places that they live. And we all have that call, you know, to tell these stories. there's so much, you know, there's so much in the public square and in the popular media that would say that religion is inherently an oppressive force. You know, that religion is, as Chris Hitchens used to say, is toxic. Religion poisons everything. And there's a sense in which the most widespread kind of understanding of the Christian faith in our culture is that it's, you know, it's intolerant, it's, you know, it suppresses, you know, individual flourishing, that it fortifies, you know, hegemonic structures and all of that. But the fact is, we have so many inspiring, beautiful stories to tell. And I have found, as an academic theologian trained in philosophical theology, that the theology that ultimately sticks is theology told as story. And yes, I think it is stories that made Bonhoeffer and King what they are, and it is stories and the exhilarating promise of the gospel and the risen Christ who broke the chains of death and set the captives free and comes to us from the far country of the triune God and is not to be identified with any political party, our nation, our tribe. Hallelujah. Yes. Those stories and that gospel in this time will come alive in your life and your witness. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.